Welcome, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva again, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you from a bright, sunny Vancouver morning. And I have the pleasure today of speaking with Jeff Wong, who is senior lecturer in primary care at Queen Mary University of London. And the reason I've asked Jeff to speak with me today is that he is one of the many guest authors who have contributed an article to the third annual State of the Science issue that Medical Education has started publishing in January every year. It's another attractive article this year. I'm particularly grateful to all the deputy editors who commissioned the pieces and the various individuals who offered their wonderful peer review and contributed to strengthening each article. And Jeff's in particular was one that I was quite enthralled, given that I've had to do some thinking myself about the advantages and disadvantages of different strategies for reviewing the literature. His article is entitled Realist Methods in Medical Education Research. What are they and what can they contribute? Thanks, Jeff, very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor.
It really is a pleasure. I wonder if I could start by asking you to tell our listeners a bit about your background and what got you into this area of scholarship in the first place.
Right. I guess the best way is, as with many things in life, it's relatively by accident. So I'm a working family practitioner, a general practitioner, as we call them in the United Kingdom, and I still see patients. And I started off my career, as many general practitioners do, in fact, doing a lot of teaching of undergraduate and postgraduate students. And my initial contracts were all for teaching posts in the various institutions I've been affiliated with. One of the things I started noticing about education is that it's highly what we call context specific, and I'm sure our readers will be very familiar with this. A lecture just isn't a lecture or any kind of intervention that we use. They just seem to vary so much, and the outcomes we get out of them seem to be so dependent on all sorts of really sometimes quite subtle things that go on during the delivery or the pedagogy, the teaching of our colleagues and students. This got me thinking, and totally by chance, the coincidence of being able to get funding and also running across one of my co-authors, Ray Pawson, who was at the time just happened to be working with one of my other co-authors, Trish Greenhouse, on a project. And we started talking about the types of review methods that might help us to understand how we could start to have a coherent, plausible, and almost systematic way of accounting for how and why it is that context is important in influencing outcomes. And this pretty much is the origins of where I came into the sort of realist review, realist research arena.
It's funny that you mentioned Ray Pawson, only because it made me recall that one of the reviewers, as many of our listeners will know, we have a blinded review process where we don't disclose the author's names to reviewers. And one of the reviewer comments, if I recall, was that you should consider Ray Pawson's work because he was doing interesting thinking in this domain as well. So clearly you did. The background you've just expressed, though, is one that in many ways is counter to what would typically be seen in the field in terms of the biomedical models coming from a clinical training background and presumably working within a biomedical model. Oftentimes that leads individuals towards being more checklist-oriented, more trying to encourage systematic sorts of reviews, and in many ways the stressors and strains of maintaining those clinical and teaching sides of your career, I can imagine, put a lot of pressure on you. How do you manage to find time for this sort of more in-depth scholarship, I might describe it as?
I think you just have to, simple answer, I think you just have to make time for it. It's interesting. Again, there are kind of lots of bits that will make a difference. I mean, for me, I've been lucky enough to be very strongly supported by one of my co-authors there, which is Trish Greenhouse, my previous head of unit and current head of unit, has been incredibly encouraging and supportive. I also find that I wish the day was about 28 hours long at times. And sometimes, you know, it's a case of putting in the extra hours to find the time. I would say that one thing that possibly potentially is different in being a general practitioner, a family practitioner, is that we're probably quite used in many instances of dealing with just not knowing everything. There's a lot of uncertainty in family medicine, as there is often in research. You know, one of the probably characteristic things of any systematic review or any trial or experiment we see is there's just more we need to know, and being comfortable with thinking, well, do we have enough to be able to do something about this, or making sense based on a limited set of data That's relatively common, I think, in family practice thinking. So that's not that unfamiliar. I think the other thing as well is that, you know, certainly in family medicine, that the context makes a huge difference as well, and probably is much more of an influence than maybe, you know, if somebody was having a bypass operation and being seen by the cardiothoracic surgeons. Yeah, context will matter. But for us, little subtle things have always been important. You know, how family dynamics are and where people live and what their social employment are, etc., things like that. Right. Have always seemed to make a difference. And so I think in health services research, there's a great scope for use of the realist methods as well.
That all makes good sense. And as you answered the question, I realize I'm remiss a little bit in that many of our readers won't know what realist methods are. So perhaps I should have started there and ask you to explain for our listeners what you're advocating in putting forward realist methods for reviews.
Right. Well, this is always the $64,000 challenge question. How short can you make it in order to make it coherent? I guess the way I kind of look at these things is to compare and contrast between what we perhaps currently do and what perhaps we should be doing in the future. I think that the thing that realist methods bring to the table is a very different way of understanding why outcomes occur. So at the moment, and I apologize if this seems a bit like a caricature, what typically happens is we can see outcomes. It might be somebody's learned something or somebody is not engaging in a course or something. And then we can often see contexts. So we can see that, oh, yes, this is a course that's in a medical school. It's in a low middle income country. It's got poor staffing, etc. So we've got all these contextual factors and we've got all these outcomes we can observe. But a question I've always asked then is, what causes these outcomes? Now, there are different philosophical ways of looking at this. Again, one might see this quite a lot in systematic reviews, an association between a particular factor, let's say gender and performance, or a racial group and performance in an examination, things like that. Mm-hmm. But they're not causative. Associations are not unimportant. They're actually very, very important because they start to indicate, well, here's a pattern. Here, we've seen something here. What's going on? Yeah, and I think this is where probably realist research and realist methods start to provide a different way of thinking about things. So this is now a different path. The work which originated predominantly from a philosopher, actually by the name of Roy Basker, postulates that the thing that sits in the middle is a mechanism. Outcomes occur because mechanisms generate them. And if I can give just a very, very simple example of this, and hopefully it'll make sense to listeners. If, let's say, you know, we're both sitting in a table and we drop a pen, the pen drops to the ground, where I'm sitting anyway, which is on Earth. So the mechanism that generates that is just gravity. Now, we can't see it. We can't even necessarily touch it. But it's real. It causes an outcome. Now, context-wise, I'm on Earth. The air has a particular density. Now, if I were sitting in a swimming pool and I dropped my pen, and my pen happened to be one of those nice wooden pens or something, it might float. The context is change. We have a mechanism, which is still gravity, trying to pull it into the water, which is why it's not floating way up into the sky. But there are other mechanisms at play here. So one of the mechanisms would be flotation. The wood has an inherent property. It's slightly less dense than the water. It floats instead because the mechanism of gravity is being countered by the mechanism of flotation. The contextual change has happened here, which is I'm in a swimming pool and there's water all around me.
How do you make sure that the specific things you're claiming to be influential in a particular context aren't just random happenstance of what happened at that moment when you collected the data?
That's a very good point. And in fact, the process of realist thinking is often about putting forward hypotheses and then testing those. So just to give an example, if we're trying to understand engagement, why is it people might use a course that's on the internet? You can see all sorts of associations. We often need to develop explanations about why those associations might be the case and what sort of potential mechanisms might be working. Initially, it is absolutely, without a doubt, conjecture. I'm not necessarily sure it's correct, but having scoped the literature, I think what might influence student engagement in online courses is these particular mechanisms are in operation.
Right.
Now, what one then does is to then look back at the literature. So in a review process, one might then look at additional journal articles of a relevant nature to see if there is data within each paper, which effectively acts like a case, to look for affirmation, things that would say, oh, absolutely, yes, I can confirm this is the case, things that would refine any particular explanation, any theory that we might have. Also, probably the most important step, things that might refute the actual inference one has made about whether or not that mechanism is important. Mm-hmm. So it's about scoping and understanding a field of topic area and then going on to build some sort of a model. In realist parlance, it's called a program theory. Program theory being very basically a description of an ideal scenario of how it is that we think something would work. Mm-hmm. And one tests to see whether all these various different assumptions about why the program would work happens to be the case or not by looking back at the literature for refinement, refutation, as well as confirmation. And this is a pretty iterative process. You'd keep looking through more and more papers. And each time the idea is about looking to see whether the same mechanisms are there, because the mechanisms are in fact a transferable bit. This is the warrant to be able to make a claim of transferability of realist data, because of the way the world is conceptualized by generating outcomes through mechanisms, because they tend to, not always, they tend to reside predominantly in us humans, particularly in education. I think we tend to be the agency, though I fully accept that there are mechanisms that also exist at perhaps the sort of institutional level. We tend to share a lot of these mechanisms, and you know, you can think of very, very simple ones, of fear or hope, wanting to achieve, jealousy, etc.
Yeah, and this reminds me, yes, of many of the conversations that I've had with respect to trying to help people position their papers in a way that will make them of interest to medical education's readership, and trying to help increase the odds that people will be successful in submitting to the journal. In that, again, risking caricature, there are many people in our field who point to a theory-practice conflict, and oftentimes my concern is that the way that theory is being defined is much grander in scale than what I generally think of as theory, which is the development of some broader understanding that comes up iteratively by taking some data and going back and forth with the literature and existing viewpoints and trying to come up with something that's broader in scope than simply these were the data that I found in my specific context. It reminds me of something that you said just before we started recording the podcast, which was that the methods can often be an iceberg phenomenon, and we often, when we're teaching research courses, tend to focus on the methods and yield the impression that there are absolute standards by which the methods have to align, and if that's done, then therefore it'll be important, good work. Can I get you to elaborate on that sentiment a little bit for the people who weren't listening before I hit the record button?
Absolutely. In fact, this, I wouldn't say this is one of my hobby horses, but I think this is where not medical education, specifically the journal, but education of doctors as a whole may well, I hesitate to say this because people are always saying things should be shoved in the curriculum, should be something that perhaps one can consider adding to the curriculum of those who want to be researchers. Certainly in my professional education as a researcher, it's learning by being an autodidact, really, and with great guidance from my supervisors during my thesis, etc., that I've only started to appreciate the importance of ontology and epistemology behind the various different research methods that we have. I mean, in a way, all our research methods have these assumptions about how the world is constituted. It's the sort of ontological position, and then what we come to value as knowledge and how knowledge is generated, which is the epistemological aspect of a research method. The difficulty, if we don't appreciate those, are that we can potentially end up assuming that there is just one way of dealing with things, and this method is the method, because what assumptions? I didn't even realize there were any behind them. I'm not saying necessarily that any methods are wrong. I think the whole reason for why there are these different methods, they're all part of the scientific process. We're all trying to deal with the problem of the underdetermination of theory, which theory is actually more correct. And all our different methods use slightly different approaches to try and tease out which is more likely. So, you know, controlled trials are absolutely fine when you can control the scenario. Mm-hmm. And it is ethical to do so. And we know that this is one of the big problems in education, is that sometimes it's unethical. You know, you can't say to one bunch of students, I'm sorry, we're not going to teach you in a good way or what we think is a good way because, well, we want you to fail. But those other souls are going to get a great service. Also, there are certainly lots of things we can't control for in education. You know, we can't control between institutions. We can't control what the culture within institutions or the quality of the teaching or the student numbers, what their intakes are like, and the baseline characteristics between institutions. So it starts to create all sorts of problems. You can't then use the same means of determining between theories in scenarios where control is basically not possible, or at best we get a semblance of control. And if we do then control, well, how do you then generalize outside of the controlled scenario?
Right, that again makes a lot of sense, and I'm conscious of the time because I realize I've already kept you longer than I said I would, but I'm quite enjoying the conversation, so it's hard to wrap this up. But I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't mind wrapping up by sharing with our listeners the biggest challenges you would anticipate for them and how you would coach them if they wanted to adopt these sort of methods, given that they're obviously much broader than we can do justice to in a brief conversation and likely in a single paper, although I think you've done an admirable job of doing that.
Right. I think what I would say to any one individual, and it's in a way a journey I've been through myself, is that thinking time is really important. And I was fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to kind of reflect and ask sometimes quite unsettling questions. And this perhaps is one of the reasons why it's sometimes difficult to accept new ways of thinking about the world. The reality is there's no one best way to think about how to tackle any particular research question. It's probably more the way that's most likely to provide the answers that will be helpful to the audience that we hope to be addressing. So being broad-minded, accepting that maybe what we do on a regular basis isn't necessarily correct, that's a real challenge. And I myself have had to go through that process of, in a way, unlearning and then relearning potentially different ways of viewing the world. And realism is but one of the various different lenses that one can use. And then within realism, there are different tribes that then emphasize different aspects of the philosophy behind how the world is constituted. So that's challenge number one. Number two is we're always happy to help, because I think part of the issue is about building capacity when something new lands on the block. And then you suddenly expect people to think, wow, I have to think about this differently. There is no, in a way, substitute for kind of being there and available. And so think broadly and then don't be scared to ask for help. And there's quite a lot of literature out there, some of it more accessible than others. There's no harm in reading it and then trying, if possible, to reflect on what the implications might be.
Well, I appreciate your generosity of spirit and won't give your contact information over the podcast, but people can find that in the paper. You reflect very well the collegiality that I've always experienced in our field as well. It's one of the great domains to work because people do seem more than willing to help out most of the time. And so I would certainly encourage people to take you and others in the field up on that opportunity rather than feeling like they have to figure it out all for themselves. But with that, I will wrap up. And again, thank you for a wonderful paper. I quite enjoyed reading it. I think it's going to make a great contribution to the January 2012 to the science issue. And I'll just remind people that I've been speaking with Jeff Wong, senior lecturer in primary care at Queen Mary University of London, and the paper that will be published in January 2012 is entitled Realist Methods in Medical Education Research: What Are They and What Can They Contribute? Thanks again, Jeff. I very much appreciate it and look forward to talking again.
Thank you very much, and it's been my pleasure.